You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Today we welcome Dr. Sang-Hyun Lee from the International Labour Organization. And he will present on wages, inequality, and development, time to turn the wheel. I just say a couple of words to introduce our speaker. Dr. Lee is an economist, has a PhD from Cambridge University, and specializes in changes in wages and working conditions. And he has published widely on the subject, but in particular, he's also one of the lead authors of the Global Wage Report, which comes out every 2 years and is a major reference for all those that are interested in the recent trends in wage development and the key issues around the wage sector. So I think this presentation will be very, very, very interesting also for us in terms of looking into and discussing one of the key characteristics of inequalities, which is income inequality and inequality in the labor market in the wage sector. So without further ado, I would like to give you the floor. And I have just two more comments to make, and I will repeat them after the seminar. Please look at the book table. Please fill in the form that was distributed. And also, this event will be recorded and later on posted on our website. So if you want to inform other colleagues who would like to see this lecture later on, it will be posted on our website.
So I have to be careful then.
careful what you say. Okay. So thank you very much, Dr. Lee.
Okay, thank you so much, actually. It's my great pleasure to be here, and I especially be grateful to UNRISTA for a kind invitation, and also thanks to Joanna, who actually provide wonderful support. And she used to be our colleagues, and I didn't realize she moved on. And so you are lucky one. I'm stuck in the island now. My presentation is basically about the trying to look at what has happened so far in terms of the wages and income distribution, and then reflecting a little bit on the where we went wrong, and if possible, then where we have to go. That is, so it's a big idea. But my best part of my slide or presentation is this one.
Oh,
can you recognize the picture up there? This is my masterpiece. Okay, but you will see better actually the pictures from the hard copy soon. I think this captures everything which I'm going to say. My presentation, as you can see, you can see lots of people on the left side. I think they are struggling. And on the right side, you can see one person with lots of money with some big catch. I think it's I don't know, exactly some big vehicle or something. That captures the situation where we are now. So many people are on the left side, just about hanging around for survival. And on the right side, we have a very small number of people who actually accumulate lots of the wealth or the income. What I like this picture is that the gentleman on the right side has only one more step to make. If that happens, you can imagine what's going to happen. So what should be done is simple to say, but it's difficult to do it, is to move the people on the right side to the right side, left to the right. If we manage to move at least some group of people on the left side to the right, probably we'll be in a more balanced, more stable situation. But if not, for example, if we do not do anything before this gentleman make a final step, we'll be in a big trouble. So that is basically the message I'm going to convey. So probably you may say, well, then you don't need further presentation. But I'm a researcher. I'm trying to support that picture with all different statistics and arguments and theories. Like, what is the motivation of the all issues for our research? Basically, we have big questions. So big questions. The first context is that there is an ongoing debate right now. Why we have a crisis? Why we have the Great Recession? There are lots of debates going on. One particular factor which has been discussed is inequality. The Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize laureate, he recently published a book on the price of inequality. Basically, he's saying, at least in the U.S., inequality is the key factor of the crisis. But the debates are going on. Some others say, well, no, Stiglitz, of course, you got the Nobel Prize, but which does not mean you are right on everything. Saying, you know, inequality, yes, something, but it's not really a key factor. Then, again, debates are going on. This actually brings us to the question, very classic question, does inequality really matter? Many people accept, you know, economists and or social scientists and all ordinary people may accept the fact, yes, inequality matters for social and political reasons, yes. But when it comes to economics, people have different views. Well, I can accept that for social reasons, but not necessarily for economic reasons. Too low inequality may suppress economic growth. That is one standard argument. And then the third one is more related to the economist thinking. I'm economist, so I'm trained in that way. How familiar you are with the economics. If you look at the so-called macroeconomics, that is very hidden. You never know. It's always hidden in deep place. Assumption that the functional income distribution is basically the income distribution between capital and labor is always stable. That's the standard assumption underlying mainstream macroeconomics. We assume them for the last 20 or 30 years at least. But now, what I'm going to do in my presentation this is not the case. Actually, the functional income distribution can change, actually have changed. Then if we found that, then what does that mean? So I'm getting into that as well. And all of this to actually lead us to our more fundamental questions that whether or not we need some new social economic paradigm, because the paradigm which exists, I don't know how to name it, but something exists, may not be very have done a very good job, so we have to change the paradigm. Otherwise, we'll get back to the same problem and again and again and again and again. So what would that be then? So that is my big questions. And published quite a number of the articles and reports. For the promotion purposes, you can see one is Global Wage Report, which just came out the last December. On the right, there is a special issue of the International Labor Review, which focuses on the low pay issues in low income countries or the emerging economies. So I'm going to circulate some the hard copies of this report and the journal. And what I have found, I just put upfront what I have found. I'm afraid, after raising big questions, what I have found is very small. So I have to apologize for that. But we are keep thinking about the big questions, but we are doing small things. At the end of the day, these all small findings will actually pave the way to some of the big ideas and big plans. There are four issues. One is what happens. First, labor income share, I'm going to explain later, has been declined. Not just in the industrial countries, also low-income countries and developing countries. Personal income distribution also got worse. Why? Of course, you may ask. Of course, a wide range of factors played, but many people point to the role of the technological changes, but our view is slightly different. We think the policies play probably a bigger role than technological changes. Then why people talking about technological change all the time? Economists always love to talk about technological changes for one simple reason. If you say technological changes, you immediately say, oh, I'm sorry for what happened, but there is nothing we can do about this. Come on, how change technology? That's not our job, right? So it's like the natural law. So that's why we economists love technological changes. But our finding is, well, there is some element of technological changes, but that's not whole story. But actually, that's a very small part of the story. And the third one is, oh, of course, this labor income share is increasing. Income distribution got actually more worse than what is the implication? Of course, social implication, yes. Political implication, yes. But that's not the focus of my presentation. My presentation is basically saying income inequality is growing, then it may lead to lower economic growth and economic stability. So income, widening income inequality is also economically bad. That's our argument. And then I touch upon the more difficult question for me. So what to do? You have said very nice things about, so what? So I'm touching upon those issues, focusing on the notion on the rebalancing. There, basically rebalancing meaning the rebalancing in income distribution at the national and global level through more effective policy intervention. I'm going to use some different concepts here and there, just to probably use. Many of you are already quite familiar with this, but just to make sure we're on the same page, I'm referring to two different types of the income distribution. One is a primary income distribution, and the second is a secondary income distribution. In the primary income distribution, there are two parts. One is how to divide the total output or total incomes between capital and labor. The second is how to distribute the workers' portion, total portion, among workers. So it's more wage inequality. So there are two different things. Of course, they are related. Of course, the secondary income distribution, I think, honestly, is more interested in this topic, but I don't want to get into the detail there. And also, I'm going to use some of the economic terms called aggregate demand. It's basically GDP. GDP is typically decomposed with the consumption and investment, export, import, and government. Okay, so I hope this is clear to you. And then I'm getting into the main part of my presentation. Why I'm talking about inequality? I don't know the unrest and in the social policies you're talking about these issues in that perspective, but as far as economists is concerned, inequality is not really important issues. I'll correct it. Inequality has not been an important issue so far. There are many, many reasons for that. One reason is because of the famous actually Kushner's curve. People, we were taught in our the PhD or in the university, saying at the early stage of industrialization, inequality will inevitably increase. But the growth continues. At the end of the day, a certain point, then the inequality start to decline. So what you have is first it's increasing and then declining at certain stage of economic growth. So if that's the case, if we consider that as kind of natural law, that is always happening, then we really don't need to worry about this. So that's one of the reasons why economists are not very much interested in inequality. But that's a nice theory. It has some evidence, but we look at what evidence we have on that. Our answer is no. The Kuznets may have lied to us, or he got the wrong data. I don't know what happened to him, but we found the evidence which is not actually supportive of his Kuznet curve. But that's not his fault. I'm getting there later in my presentation. And then economists all of a sudden realize, oh, the evidence is different. No, that's not quite what we have expected. then economists are always smart and proposing some new strategy, saying, look, there are two different types of inequality. One is good inequality, the other is bad inequality. So good inequality, if good inequality in the sense it provides an incentive for workers to work harder. So if you get more salaries and you may work harder, compared to the situation everybody paid exactly the same. And the bad inequality is basically somehow you're trying to intervene directly in the income distribution. That's a kind of the policy intervention trying to address. That is kind of the notion came from basically trying to link that to the notion of the bad inequality. This is the old context. As you see, this is a graph. We put the economic growth on the y-axis, this Gini coefficient. You may not see the clear patterns. If Kuznets is right, then we have to expect something like this. But what we have found is a bit of cyclical. It's up and down kind of thing. So we don't know exactly what is the relationship between the two. That's the context number one. The second is about the wage inequality. I don't need to spend much time on this. It's simple. There are so many different ways of measuring the income, the wage inequality. One is just purely looking at the bottom scale or bottom part of the labor market, low pay. It's typically defined by the 2/3 of the median wages. When we look at that, low pay is increasing everywhere. At least 2/3 of the countries around the world right now have seen the low pay incidence increasing. Another way of looking at it is what we call the decile ratio. The top wage earners and the lowest the paid earners, we compare what is the gap. Again, the same story, it's increasing everywhere. So that's context number two. Which all of this, first, a very ambiguous relationship between inequality and growth, and the second is the growing inequality among wage earners, is fundamentally related to what I call the functional income distribution or the labor income share. Labor income share is the portion of the total compensation basically paid by the companies as part of the total the national income. As I said, economists always say it's stable because the capital labor is always negotiating over the total output. So the division weight, the share the each party will take will be the same. But as you can see, is it clear to you? Because there is color is not very clear. But anyway, I'm going to explain. Labor income share in the most advanced countries has been increasing until 1970s, the late 1970s. Then there is a big turnaround around the 1980s. And since then, in all countries, without any exception, they're all the decreasing trend in the most of countries. You may say this is only for the industrial countries. Possibly yes, but not always. This is the data from the different countries. As you can see, there is some downward trend until the 1980s, around the mid-1980s, and then start to increase a little bit. But for some reason, I'm going to explain later, for some reason around the 1990s, not 1980s, in the industrial countries, about the 1990s, all of a sudden, decline trend started. So this the same story. And you may be interested in China, the same story. China, until the overtrend is declining, but that trend has been particularly strong around the 2000s. So that declining trend continued even now in China. So overall, we have strong evidence that labor income share has not been stable. Actually, it has been decreasing very significantly in most of the countries.
very significantly. Yeah. It goes from 70 to 65 in half a century.
No, actually, it's more than that, actually. So here's, you can see, here the...
No, but the one before.
One before. So I'm getting so into
basically the... Basically, it's from 70 to, the, to 65 in 40 years.
The, if you start with the 1980s...
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay,
so so yeah. That's it, okay.
I have not been briefed on the misdeeds of statistics.
Ah, I'm sorry. That's my fault, don't be worried. Okay. I have to, yeah, I should explain more, actually, further details, but that's my fault, actually. And why this happened? The critical reason is that probably you, if you learn actually economic theory, you, the first thing you will learn is that wages will be determined by labor productivity, for sure. So what are wages? Wages are the portion workers will receive in return for their contribution to total output. So that's labor productivity. So by definition, the wages should be in line with labor productivity. But that is exactly where it went wrong. This is the index we calculated for the last almost the 12 years or so, comparing labor productivity and wages. The line below, the bottom line, is basically the real wage growth. The line, the up top line, is the labor productivity growth for last 12 years. As you can see, there is a gap between wages and labor productivity. There is no sign of narrowing. It's simply growing over years. Still, actually, when we have the crisis in the 2007 and 8, we expected that gap may be narrowing down, but that's not what we have. That's not what happened. So we are wrong. There is no sign of the actually of reversing this trend at the moment. Think, probably you can think of this way: if workers receiving less than labor productivity, what's going to happen? That gap. That gap is taken by capital. So that's why all of a sudden we see the big changes in the functional income distribution. So capital profit share is increasing and labor income share is falling, simply because of the increasing gap between wages and productivity growth. Then the next question, why did that happen? Why economists are wrong? All the assumption is wrong. Why the workers all of a sudden did not receive the probably what they deserve to be paid? And there are lots of factors, like technological changes, globalization and financialization, labor market institution, and the welfare side. Right now, there are lots of studies on this. So I'm going to summarize some of them, but I just present our own findings, which is a bit different from the standard views, but we are quite confident our findings are very rigorous and solid. At the end of the story, in here is the most tricky part is the, you have to think about yourself how wages are determined. Many people say the wages are determined by market. But if we believe that there should be some consistency between wage growth and labor productivity growth, but it didn't happen. So we suspect that has something to do with the changes in the bargaining position between workers and employers. But it's interesting enough, the all the factors we identify, like globalization and financialization, and the market institution, welfare states, and social policies, will all affect the bargaining position of workers for the last, last two decades. So what is our result? We have done lots of the number crunch work, like for the last 30 years, creating some of the panel data. We run about the 100 regression over there. This is the final result. We also surprised by the finding. The most important single factor which can explain the declining labor income share is financialization. So the more enterprises are exposed to the finance sector and also influenced by finance sector, their decision, and also their exposure to some countries' exposure to other countries in terms of financial transaction. That is the most important. About this 46% of the decline can be explained by this. The next is, as expected, labor market policies and social policies and welfare policies altogether. That's about 25%. The next one is globalization, which is measured by the total, the sum of the export and import out of the total GDP, so the exposure of the countries to the external trade. But surprisingly, only 10% can be explained by technological changes. So from this, we say probably the decline in labor income share has more to do with the policies rather than the technological changes. Why we call the policies for this financialization, labor market, and the globalization, simply because it has something to do with the policy shift in the financial market regulation and labor market regulation and also the social policies in general. Then, okay, having said this, okay, this is all nice story. So probably it may not matter that much because at the end of this inequality, so what? And so to address those issues, we're trying to see what is the economic consequences of the declining labor income share. So this is the frame we have. So if there is changes in labor income share, I'm trying to explain rather in plain, in a simple way. If the labor income share is falling, so the workers, generally as a whole, have received a small part of the total income, which means they have less to spend. So the declining in the labor income share will reduce consumption, right? But then you can expect some problem. But that's not the end of the story. The other side of the story is that there is an increasing the profit share, then companies will have more resources to invest. So you may expect the falling labor income share may boost actually the investment. So it depends on which one is bigger than the other in the end. And also, if the labor income share is falling, so we call it unit labor cost is falling as well, so that may actually boost the actual exports and a bit reducing the imports. So we expect some positive impact on that export. So in our view, at the end of the day, how actually this actually changes in income distribution will affect economic growth is basically a matter of the empirical question. So that's why we did. Can you see the figure? Okay. So again, we look at all the big macro data for the last 30 years to estimate the impact of the labor income share changes on each macro factors. The first thing we found is the effect on consumption is very large. If the labor income share is falling by 1%, it will reduce consumption by between 0.3 and 0.5%. So it's a big impact. So that's what actually the second actual column actually tells us. And as I said, if the labor income share is falling, union labor cost is actually decreasing, then investment will increase. That's what we expect to happen. But surprise, surprise, that didn't happen. Profit share is increasing, but that doesn't translate into the higher investment. So as you can see in the third column, some countries like the United States and also Korea and some other countries like even the United Kingdom and Turkey in some different countries, even if the profit share is increasing, there is no impact on the investment. So which basically meaning the company is actually keeping all the increased profit share either in cash or putting the money in other places. So where have they put the money? That is the question. So the answer is, of course, financial sector. There is some positive impact on net exports, but altogether, if we actually put together all this effect, the answer is simple. If labor income share is declining, then the economic growth will suffer. That's what we found from our macro analysis. So the worsening or growing income inequality is economically negative. So that is not just socially. Then how countries manage that, all these problems? So, okay, I'm trying to guide you a little bit. So consumption is falling like this, and investment actually don't increase that much, then you have a problem with the aggregate demand. You have to compensate it somewhere. Otherwise, your economy would collapse. Then the question is, how countries manage to handle this problem? There are two ways of handling. The first one is, you don't have workers don't have money to spend, right? And then there is a simple way of de-boosting consumption. So simply, we can provide cheap credit to workers and poor households. That's exactly what happened in the United States. So they provide cheap credit to the ordinary workers, and then they can buy. They maintain the consumption, if you like, and based on this. And we know the result. This strategy is not sustainable. At the end of the day, we have the financial crisis in the United States. The second option is you simply export more. So you have a problem in your country, but you simply export your problems as well to other countries. Okay, so that's what happened in China and Germany. That's why indeed right now, the Germany actually has been severely criticized for their selfishness, because they actually keep the wages down like this, and the labor income share is falling, but they managed to grow simply by exporting more to their neighboring countries, like Greece, Spain, and Italy. Sounds familiar, you know, what happened in these countries. But this is typical the beggar thy neighbor's policies. And of course, this is not viable either. It is not viable either, because if you want to export more, there should be a country who are willing to import more, right? So this country will have the problem as they are, even worse. There are only small pocket of the countries who can enjoy this actually unique strategy. So globally speaking, this strategy is not working. And then, okay, this is something, a very sad story. So we're trying to turn around, doing some dissimulation. Okay, labor income share has been falling. Then what if countries altogether probably somehow, for some reason, decided to increase labor income share by 1%? Then what's going to happen? So that's kind of the simulation we did. I don't want to get into detail in here. The result is there is a very significant effect on the economic growth, or positive effect. Economy will grow, and especially the effect will be much bigger if the older countries maintain the labor income shares at the level 20 years back. So probably I get into it very quickly. Our assumption is somehow the older country here maintain the level of the labor income share around the 1980s, then probably what would be the net effect of the economic growth is very, very significant. So that is the what this chart shows. Probably you can see all the details in our the report. Then probably so far it is all abstract. Probably it's all global. You know, it's like the I'm working for the IMF or something. But I'm just putting you in the context. The Korea. Korea in social policy, as far as I know, Korea has been praised for many reasons. One of the big reasons for that is that Korea managed to grow, yes, but in a rather equitable manner, meaning the income inequality has been reduced, although the economic growth was very high. So that's why the Korea is always called a champion of equitable growth. But that's past story. It's all gone. Okay, so this is one example. In Korea, if you look at the labor income share, so there is a very nice story going up and going up until 1997. I just hope you remember the year of 97 throughout the end of the presentation on Korea. So 97, that's when the financial crisis broke out. Before that, we had a moment of the big shift for the direct democracy, and also the all of a sudden workers began to organize. There is a big push on social policies in Korea. So thanks to that, all the, in the context of those policies, the labor income share increased quite significantly, and then all of a sudden falling down a little bit. And that's not the end of the story. If we look at the trend between real wages, wage growth, and labor productivities, all of a sudden in Korea start to see the gap is growing between labor productivity and wages. When? 97 is when financial crisis broke out in Korea. The gap is simply growing. Okay, so now, no wonder income inequality in Korea, either personal income distribution or the functional income distribution, as we saw, all increasing. Then what about these poor workers, poor households? So we look at the low pay incidents. The same story. Around the late 1980s, the Korea start to see the low pay incidence is decreasing thanks to a lot of the policy initiative, including minimum wages, all the nice things. But all of a sudden, it all stopped. That's when 97. That's financial crisis. And then start to increase. That trend is more or less continue at the moment. And the final piece of the story is that I have to rush up. Okay. You may think that Korea is always exporting more than import, but which is not the case. Before financial crisis, Korean economy always import more than export. That's a way of growing the economy. So in terms of trade, actually, before the 97, Korea had always had the trade deficits. So that problem has been always tackled by, the changing exchange rate. But all of a sudden, after 97, the Korean economy is transformed itself into the trade surplus countries. So all of a sudden, net export increasing. That makes perfect sense because as I said, labor income share is falling, labor unit cost is falling. In doing so, the Korean economy always managed to handle their problems simply by exporting more than imports. So this is what happened in Korea. So probably the Dr. Il Chung Lee knows about this very well, so he has the full picture of that policy changes. What all of this tell us, possibly, get back to the question, why labor income share has been falling in the first instance? And what has been the economic consequences? Just from the very descriptive actual statistics on the key trend, you may suspect everything happens after financial crisis. After financial crisis, what happened in Korea? There is a big policy shift under the pressure from the IMF towards liberalization policies. Labor market has been flexibilized. There is the big liberalization of the financial sectors, on and on and on. So this period is coincided with a big policy shift in Korea as well. So this is all empirical evidence so far. So I'm doing okay also?
Yeah.
Okay. So what? No, I'm not asking you. So I'm asking it to myself. So what? So this is nice data or nice analysis. So what? Of course, I have to admit, I'm still reflecting on these issues. So this is a good opportunity for me to actually share my thinking. Also, I'm happy to hear from you what you are thinking about this. Observation number one, if you remember all the empirical evidence I present, is that labor income share trend is something to do with policy shift. As you remember, in the advanced countries, when actually labor income share started to fall, that's 1980s. As you remember, what happened in 1980s? Big shift to neoliberal policies, right? And in other countries, that actually change started about the 1990s, around 1990s, early or delayed. In Korea, it's 97. That's exactly when policy shift occurred.
Just one question.
Yep.
If the trend had not reversed and the share of labor had continued to go up, in which year would the share of wage reach 200% of.
No, that's not possible actually. So
yeah, maybe precisely that's something we should take.
Actually, we haven't calculated. So that's something I will do. So I will send the email. You'll take a couple of minutes to calculate that. Yeah.
Good. I would be very curious. To
okay.
That figure.
Before I forget. Yeah. And that's observation number one. Number two is, so probably we said that the probably growing inequality is not very good for economy as either. So we have to probably put it back. So how can you do that? Then probably, again, we need a complete different thinking or approach to the policies. Unless we change our policies, we may not expect any significant change in income distribution. That's our guess from what we have seen from empirical evidence. And third one is, okay, Kuznets. I really feel sorry for the Kuznets. Kuznets always blamed, your theory is somehow actually encourage economists to completely ignore the inequality. But that's not what actually Kuznets said in his original paper. In his paper, what he said is that, of course, at a certain point, inequality start to fall, not because of economic reason, because of the political social reasons. Inequality is growing. People, all of a sudden, very much worried about social cohesion and other issues, and the workers start to organize themselves to increase the pressure on the policymakers and the politicians. That's exactly what happened in Germany and the UK and other countries. So probably if we understand Kuznets more accurately or more in line with what he said in his paper, like in 1953 papers, and probably we may have a different view on the inequality issues. This is another big story. In my guess, it has something to do with the Karl Polanyi's conundrum. Probably you all know about this. Karl Polanyi basically said there is always tension between the market and the society. So sometimes going to the neoliberal and commodifying everything, and if it reached the extreme, actually the pendulum moving back to the more state or the state or society regulations to decommodify the labor and land or something like that. So it sounds like as if the pendulum is moving always like that automatically. But now what actually Polanyi said is he actually identified the people who are moving the pendulum. In the case of the United States, there are organized workers and enlightened actually businessmen who actually organize themselves, putting pressure, Roosevelt basically, to change the policies. But in this crisis, surprisingly, we do not see that. Why? Because the pendulum is not automatic. Somebody should carry it over. But I don't see who they are at the moment. That's where we have problem. That's the observation number three. And so in terms of the policy, what policy we should look at, probably it's pretty much obvious. We actually propose three things. One is, the bottom line is that we have to make effort to reconnect wage and productivities. And this is not actually a single man show. One country can do that, but it has limited impact. Because there are all different strategies. Countries may have different strategies. So there is a strong need for the coordination at the global level. In doing so, actually, labor market institutions should be strengthened. Particularly, we are concerned about the rather unbalanced bargaining position right now between workers and the companies at the moment. And as I said, the more important issue, probably more urgent issue, is the financial regulation. That is the concern. As you can see later, companies are sitting on lots of cashes at the moment, but they don't make investment. Why? Because they used to invest this money in the financial commodities or financial, the financial market, broadly speaking. But they cannot do it now. But they are still very unwilling to put their money in the real investment. So that, as a result, they are sitting on the big pile of the cashes at the moment. And the taxation and social security is a very important part of the story, but I don't want to spend time on this because you are all experts on this. And for developing countries, we are particularly concerned about the informal sectors. I'm getting into there in a minute. And also social security schemes. And the finance sector, this is some simple the trend. We actually estimate the dividend payout between 2000 and 2011. It doesn't matter. Crisis, forget it. It's simply increasing. You may expect the crisis period, the dividend payment, by definition, economic performance is worse, then dividend payments should be smaller, but that's not what happened. It's increasing. There is a bit of a hiccup around 2007, but it started to grow. We have a fundamental problem with here. Companies have lots of the capacity to invest. They do have resources, but they simply don't do it. That has something to do with the current status of the financial market regulation and other issues. And when it comes to labor market issues, we think, yes, labor market policies are important, but it's not working always very well. Two aspects. You may say collective bargaining is improving, then probably the low pay incidence will be decreasing. Yes, that is true. But the relationship is not very strong. And this is something we are looking into there as well. And also the minimum wage is the same. People may always suggest the minimum wage as a way of protecting low-pay workers, but this is a more subtle business. Of course, if you have minimum wage at the too low level, it doesn't matter. But if minimum wage is too high, it is not going to be enforced in any case. That's why we look at the relationship between minimum wages here and the low pay incidence is high and increasing as minimum wage is going up. And then if minimum wage is going up further, low pay incidence is increasing. Why? Because these minimum wages are very high. They are not relevant for low paid workers. They are not being enforced. So that's why there is some U-shaped curve. We explained this, the issues in our special issues of the International Labor Review. I think I'm under time pressure. So I think the labor market policy itself is useful but not completely effective. And this is something we are looking at now. We are trying to distinguish two different things. One is the wage poverty and is income poverty. So why we worry about wages? Because we want to protect workers from the poverty by providing reasonably sufficiently high wages. But sometimes, even though the workers receive something reasonable in quote wages, they may not be sufficient to get out of the poverty at the household level, because the poverty is normally defined at household level. So there is a way of the kind of the disconnecting the linkage between the wages and poverty through some of the income support. But we especially for the second type of risk, we are thinking of the all income related policies, but all the examples provided in this slide actually have been strongly advocated by UNWIST. That's my understanding. But the key point, I don't have an answer to that, but our gut feeling is that we have been doing quite okay on the labor market side. Probably we have done quite okay on the probably social security or income policy side, okay. But we still don't know how to best articulate or integrate these two set of policies to produce the maximum effect for the poor household. So we are doing our own technical expertise, but we are not very good at actually putting them together to produce effective active policy framework. Probably that's just for ILO, but But so sometimes when looking at the other the reports on the social policies, they are not very articulate on the labor market side either. So this is a two-sided of story. I think we hope, I hope actually, in the future there is a better actually understanding of these two issues and to have a better policy suggestions, which actually put those two sets of policies in a more effective way. So this is my final slide, and this is actually Joanna asked me to do. Actually, ILO is also talking about MDGs. So last time, ILO somehow managed to bring in our issues into MDG last minute, basically. We just managed it. So now the current MDG recognize the importance of the employment. That's it. And there is a bit of the issues related to gender and others, but child, and it's a bit marginal from our perspective. And we do have a problem with that, because full employment is a good idea. We always advocate it. But in different countries, full employment doesn't make much sense. Because at the end of the day, workers are fully employed. In the sense that if you don't have a job in the company, you just go out to the street or selling something, then you are classified as being employed. So that's why employment rate in different countries is always higher than middle-income countries, by definition, because they cannot afford being unemployed. So the full employment itself doesn't make much sense. So we think some of the job quality dimensions should be included. That's why. But that is not related to my presentation itself. My thinking is that the next MDG, if I understand the MDG, is some kind of platform for kind of shaping new socio-economic paradigm for more sustainable, equitable growth. In that case, this actually new MDG should explicitly recognize the issue of inequality. The current MDG tends to emphasize more on the equality in opportunities. I fully agree, that's important. But that's not enough. We have to recognize the importance of inequality in terms of outcome as well, so income as well. So unless we do that, there is a significant risk, again, not just in the social outcome, but also in economic outcome. So I just hope this issue will be reflected in the next forthcoming discussion on the MDG. And final question is that it's more political question. Also, that has been my question for last 2 or 3 years. I'm a researcher, so of course provide some of the policy advice to different countries. It's always say very nice things about this, but at the end of the day, I just keep wondering, who's going to do this? Okay, to be fair, I said I made a very strong call for rebalancing in the income distribution. Otherwise, you would be in trouble. So that's what I said, basically. And then the next question I should ask is that, okay, who's going to take that issue on board and to try to push and changing the policies? If we can ask ourselves, if the existing political system or the politicians and policymakers are willing to do so, if they actually see the points, okay, inequality is important, Obama says lots of things about this, would that be enough to turn the wheel? Or the most important issue for us is to identify who will be social forces which actually take this agenda to the politics. Probably there is a way of doing that. So, and then following question is, who they are? Where are they? We used to rely very much on trade unions. That's what happened, the Great Depression in the 1920s, 30s. But when we are looking around, they are not there. So,
Why?
Yeah, that's my question. So then, the question is, are we going to re-strengthen the trade union? Would that be, then question is, would that be good strategy at this particular moment? Or we have to look for alternative social forces as well? Or we have to be more creative about this issue? That is pretty much open question. I don't have any answer to that. I hope actually the you in this room will have time to think about it, or if you have already some good view on this, I would be very happy to listen to that. Thank you very much for your attention. It went a bit longer than I expected, and my apologies for that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for this fascinating presentation, and I will open the floor almost immediately. I just want to summarize very, very quickly that Sanghan has taken us in a little bit more than half an hour through the recent trends in wage inequalities and functional income distribution inequalities. Wage inequalities, the trends in personal income distribution. He has given us data on the developed countries, on the advanced countries, on the trends over the last four decades, on developing countries, and he has zoomed in on the case study of Korea to give us a little bit more flesh on this debate and to show that there are actually, even in those countries that are kind of the poster childs of equitable growth, there are really, we can clearly distinguish between a period that is in a way similar to what many of the advanced countries experienced until the 80s, until the early 80s, and what kind of happened with the time lag in Korea, but also reached in a way at its point of maturity, and due to crisis and policy changes then, fed into a new period where we can actually see increasing inequalities, increasing low pay shares in the workforce, increasing informality, despite, let's say, quite a positive initial income distribution because of the reforms the country has done, etc. So I would like to open the floor and invite you to ask questions and to provide comments also on the very interesting last questions of Dr. Lee of who are the agents of change in this picture, which is of course a little bit worrying. El-Chung, okay. would you please introduce yourself also?
I'm El-Chung, research coordinator of Omnibus. Thank you very much for this fascinating presentation about Wei-Chi and Hong Kong. My question is related to Sam's last question, who is going to do it? And another question related to what shall we do? First one, what shall we do? I mean, the disparity between wage and productivity is not new, actually. In the 1970s, when the golden age of worker states in the West reached its peak, there was a kind of disparity between productivity and wage. In that period, productivity was far below than wage. So people started talking about rebalancing between wage and productivity, and neoliberal came up with the idea of relaxing labor market and kind of a structure adjustment and all that. So the policy they came up with was to lay off workers and try to kind of break down the rigidity of income security and job security. And now we have different type of disparity between wage and productivity. And the question is whether we want to go back to the golden age of a welfare state until the 1970s, or we need a new solution. I mean, in the last slide you touched upon the issue of employment. So we cannot, it is not kind of desirable to talk about full employment in developing countries context, because you know, employed workers in informal sector has a very, very low wage. Mm-hmm. So you talked about decent job, job quality. So I wonder whether, is there any other things we have to think about when we consider new solution or new strategy to deal with this disparity between wage and productivity? That is one question related to what shall we do. Second one is related to who is going to do. When you talked about trade union, and I have a slightly different idea about trade union, because of course, I mean, it's true that trade union density is declining, but the more important thing in labor studies related to this kind of organizational capacity or mobilizing power of trade union is collective bargaining coverage rather than density. And if we think collective bargaining coverage in these days, I mean, considering, given that we have a huge number, huge kind of a share of informal sector in both developed and developing countries, I mean, strengthening trade union cannot be the answer to kind of protect those workers in informal sector or in non-standardized employment, especially in developing countries, especially in China, in India, you know, where we have more than 90% of informal workers working. I think maybe we have to think about different way to find out agents of change. So I wonder whether you have different idea from that trade union density or whatever, or strengthening the trade union. Those are the questions.
Okay.
Peter. I'm Peter Rafting, Deputy Director at ANRIS. It's on the politics of change. You know, I think today's situation, in some respects, we can perhaps be a bit more optimistic. We don't just have to rely on trade unions and the labour movement. We have citizens, we have consumers perhaps starting to think a bit more about sustainable development issues. We have social movements, etc. But we perhaps shouldn't be putting too much emphasis on those movements. If we look at progressive change historically, what changed was the relative balance of power, where, yes, some movements influenced, had greater influence and struggled and could get gains, but powerful interest also weakened.
Okay.
So I think the other question is what's going to happen on that side of the equation? so this is just...
That's right.
You first.
Sorry, you were first.
Hello, I'm Tom Marcelino from Good Neighbors International. We are an NGO working on the development humanitarian work, and we are working in a very underdeveloped country doing community development projects and income generation projects that we have in this underdeveloped country. My question, I think, is a bit addressing a bit the core work of ILO when addressing decent job, reducing poverty, and trying to cope with inequality in the work, the labor market. First, as if we put normality or being normal as a median or the means of human history, I think, even though after the 1980s we are high above the means of human history in terms of inequality and job poverty. But what I would like to say is that when ILO addresses the different standards on decent job, reducing poverty and inequality, do you think this is generally viable or is an idea for the project? Because given the limits of the resources and the world and the reality, won't it be, I mean, the kind of standards that we are trying to push here would be some kind of high minimum wages that in reality are very difficult to approach. So that's my
Question. Yeah.
The rule hasn't changed.
Okay.
Hi, thanks so much for the talk. I'm Minasua Shaya Robson, I work at Baghdad. I actually came 10 minutes into the presentation, so I didn't really nail on what data sets were based. my understanding was that it was based mostly on developed countries. At some stage you had a list of individual countries on the table, and some of them were, southern countries, but it seemed to me that it was mostly OECD countries. So if you could just clarify on that. And then the second question is, have you looked into current trends at country level in trying to do something about, the priority given to the financial sector versus the real economy. If you were to refer, for example, to the situation in France right now with the socialist government, I think they started to implement, at least in public companies, a sort of maximum wage allowed for CEOs. I think it's about €450,000 or something along those lines. And Switzerland recently, there was this public outcry for the Novartis CEO who's left the company and was supposed to earn 70 million francs, and now apparently he's said no to all of that. So I guess what I want to know is, have you looked into what's been put in place recently, but perhaps also over the past 10 years or so, or even 20 years since this trend started in the 1980s, and what effect? And then secondly, at the regional level, in terms of the race to the bottom that you mentioned, obviously policies put in place in one country won't be effective if the neighboring country, in Europe again, the UK saying come to us, if you're not happy in France, wouldn't be really effective if there weren't any laws at the regional levels actually enforcing, being really, I would say, with the enforcement power that it might have. And again, do you have any examples of any attempts to do that from a regional level?
Okay.
From other regional economic blocs? And thirdly, are you actually hopeful that there would be a real trend towards trying to reduce the gap between wages and productivity?
Yeah.
How do you see the future, so to speak?
Okay, thank you.
So I have two very simple questions, and I will get, your sympathy by first making a constructive suggestion. We have to introduce ourselves, so I am probably the only person in this room who has no vested interest in believing in your conclusions. I am a journalist freelance. So my suggestion is that you soon invite Mr. Omar Angalanis, or what is the actual name. The key of your demonstration was a table with figure proving that the side effects of wage, the share of wage in favor of exports and productivity was not at par with the shortcoming in terms of wages. I would be very curious to know how you can fix this in a single table on such an explosive issue, which has been at the core of all the controversies on economic policy for 2,000 years. So I suggest that you invite these two guys or ladies or one guy and that you supply them with a good tomato-proof jacket. So that was my constructive suggestion. Then I come to my question. Why did you end your presentation with at the end of the day, when you know that it is more at the start of the day? Because all these social forces, and it goes back to my suggestion, are in fact in total state of disagreement. There has been the century of the wage earner, worker, and now there is a century of the consumer who revenge beaten. So the issue of mobilization is more like the start of the day than the end of the day. The issue is not fixed. And my last question, while hearing this presentation, I have had displayed before my eyes gender and agriculture after neoliberalism. This is a kind of issue which you should be very, very much interested in. So do you think that these speakers could come to the conclusion, even if it were true, that neoliberalism is good for gender and agriculture.
Go on.
Thank you.
Okay.
Are there any further questions? So I think we have already we have a long list.
Yeah, it's
so I invite you to. I won't add my own because I can see that you're already challenged. So yes, please.
Okay, let's start. Probably I'm working backward actually, starting from where you said a simple question, which are not simple at all. Let's start with the poster there, gender and agriculture after neoliberalism.
What I mean is, can I trust ILO to be unbiased? As there is no consumer organization within the UN system, so we have wage earner agency.
No, actually, that is
brainwashing us.
probably the thing is the. Probably I'm not the best person to respond to your question. Probably we need a director general of the office. The ILO is not actually workers' agencies. This is tripartite agencies, and in which there are quite a wide range spectrum of the views. We have very neoclassical people. And we have almost close to the Marxist as well. So the beauty of our office is we have ongoing debate on the policies. Of course, the results were actually reported in the Global Wage Report, but that's the end product. Before getting there, I don't know how many meetings we had. We have always very lively and frank discussion on the findings, which are not really that friendly. And so we go through difficult actually process of the reviewing and the checking and validating etc. So of course people may say it's still biased because at the end of that's the conclusion we pick up but we try to make sure at least trying to be a bit balanced. So I hope that addressed your concern. But I'm more interested in your question about the consumption and the consumers. That is related to the some of the questions to the previous actually commentators as well. Why we look at this a bit, but we actually gave up. One of the complications we have nowadays, actually in terms of social forces, there is something's going on between the linkage between the wage earners and consumers. And over period, I'm not sure this is recent or it used to be like that. There is some kind of psychologically speaking, different contrasting perspective within the same body. So you have a bit different the political or policy views as a consumer, and also a bit different views as you are looking at the issues from the workers' perspective. That tension is very, very clear when we have a debate on the, for example, shop opening hours. And that is just one example. That actually spread over to other policy issues. I don't know how to understand this. And that has something to do with the state of the social forces, actually. So, but that is my guess, but I don't know. And then the two comments from the colleagues from the UNCTAD, the data set we look at is mainly G20 countries cover actually the both actually industrialized, advanced and different countries. And the country level development, actually, you actually pick up a very good point. When we look at when this actually financial crisis broke out, we made lots of expectations. So this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Most of them, we failed. And one of them is that, historically speaking, labor income share is falling during the crisis, and they normally picking up. Because, you know, the wages have some kind of the downward stickiness, actually. So the wages actually, the adjustment is a bit slower than economic actually downturn. So by that, we expect kind of at least 2 or 3 years, actually, some kind of reversal trend in the labor income share. We are wrong. That's only 1 year. 1 year a bit reversing and then start to decline again. All the OECD countries, we don't know in different countries yet. So which basically means the policies the countries have taken so far may not have that significant impact on the income distribution, or the policies may take more time to have effect. So we don't know which one is a more accurate interpretation on that. And the regional level development is very complicated story, also related to export. And there is the recognition of the problem, I believe, among the policymakers, especially financial ministers as well, relating to export. And but as you know, this is a classic problem of the collective action. So everybody's taking the same action at the same time. We are in better situation, but some people taking action a bit late or don't take any action, you are back to the square one. That's why I think that's more or less the way of, I think, describing the current situation. And so the G20 meeting is coming up soon, and so I think this issue will be discussed there, but I don't know what will be the outcome. But if it is very interesting to look at what's happening in China in that respect. China recently produced a very nice, actually, policy kind of blueprint, which basically tried to tackle the income distribution. They are not interested in tackling income distribution per se, because they realize export-led strategy is not working very well, or working not very well as it used to be. So they're trying to turn their policies to boost the domestic demand. So in achieving that, of course, this is catching two birds with one stone. So the addressing the social and the political issues at the same time, ways of the addressing the aggregate demand issues through policies, it has been effective so far. And so if the China follows suit, as they promised, that they may create a different dynamics, but I don't know. That is purely my guess. So there is some significant development actually happening around the world. And the my friend the Hans' question about the how applicable this work agenda for low income countries. Again, I'm not the best person to answer that question. Probably Director General maybe have some good answer, much better answer than me. But our approach is not this is a bit, people are tired of hearing that again and again. Well, we do not advocate the one-size-fit approach. So we have different strategy for low-income countries, especially when it comes to the minimum wages and the labor market institutions. In there, the focus is on the more informal workers there, because the countries there have a very relative small segment of the formal employment. So in there, the focus tends to be normally how to create the better conditions for employment and also the social security and social protection measures. So that's why the social protection measure, social protection floor, we advocating, and probably you may not very happy with that, because we are not very ambitious as we have to be, but at least that concept is the one of the most important entry point for the low-income countries. And the Ilcheng's questions are very difficult to me, because fortunately Peter left already, so I don't need to answer his questions, so I have time for this. I do not think we are talking about the getting back to the golden age of capitalism in the 1970s, because it's not ideal. Second, it's not possible. The conditions actually underlying this golden age of capitalism are all gone. Where are they? I don't know. So, which actually brings us very difficult questions. What is a new paradigm? What kind of social paradigm? This is purely my personal view. The upshot of the golden age of capitalism in the 1970s is basically built on the idea of the Fordism. That's a very production and manufacturing biased approach, if you will. But I don't think that's the way forward. Right now, even now, even in China right now, we're talking about, okay, China is what? World factory. But if you look at the proportion of the manufacturing employment in China, it never increased. So they keep the same proportion of workers in the manufacturing sector simply producing more. So the manufacturing sector is not the key contributor to employment creation in China anymore. So the any strategy building on like more 1970s idea would not be working. So that is bring me to the question about the consumer as well. So we have quite a diversified the structure or with quite a differentiated social actors at the moment. I think each group of social actors are doing their things, I guess. There are lots of things going on, the consumer movement, and some things are going on, labor movement and some others, and lots of the civil society organizations all there. But it's related to Peter's question. What's lacking is, I don't see any one big factors or the agenda which actually mobilize all these people together and they're working on one agenda and to make a difference. This is not a very good example. If we look at what happens in the 1980s, neoliberal policies, you may assume these people at the time actually had a very full range of the policy options and then implemented. No. They are tackling one issue after another. They focus only one thing. And then building on that success, they're expanding their agenda. That's what happened. Okay, 1980s, okay, that's what that did. She just focused first on the privatization. Not talking about financialization at all. Only one thing. Once she succeeded on that, and moving on agenda one after another. So that's the focus. They are very good at that. So because at that time the privatization actually captured all imagination and attention from the all social forces at the time. So they actually managed to actually mobilize in that direction. So I wonder, we can learn from that experience. So what will be the one single most important issues which addressed the common concerns and interests of the social actors right now? That I don't know. So that is probably I'm a bit lost. But I think many people in this room are also thinking on that issues as well. And finally on the trade unions, of course there is a gap between the trade union density, membership, and the coverage. In France, union membership is about the 15%. But the coverage is about 70% because they have an extension mechanism. That's how we call it. So even though you are not union members, you basically can cover it by relevant collective agreements. That is a brilliant idea. In countries where the system already in place, but think about the countries where such a system doesn't exist. And we're saying, let's introduce an extension mechanism. To me, it's almost like a new revolution. So it's a very attractive idea, but unless we have a strong political forces to back it up, and then it's very difficult to actually argue for that right now, because extension mechanism is always introduced when actually the government is rather authoritarian. Austria is one example. Austria is a perfect example for extension mechanism that was developed under rather authoritative political regimes at the time. And so we can be a bit more creative about how to extend the collective agreement to unorganized workers. But the probably existing mechanism, we can learn from the existing mechanism, but we have to be a bit more creative to somehow modify the system into the new circumstances. And that's...
How did the employers camp come unified to support these conclusions?
This is not a matter of the universal agreement from workers and employers. Even the paper, the report has been severely criticized by actually workers, trade unions, not employers. So they're not very happy with our conclusion at all. We say because I didn't say that much, because we are very skeptical about the trade union impact on this matter. And so trade union can do something, but we are not quite sure how important it will be. We said that in the report. So they are not happy with that either. So also there are lots of the arguments which make the employees unhappy as well. So in a sense, nobody's happy with the report.
Much braver than we. So.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is more actually, this is my personal view based on what is said officially in the report. So, but I have to be careful because this recording is going on. So I just hope I have opportunity to review it and to see if there is any sensitive.
I'm sure. Okay, so maybe I take this as the final statement, but without saying that we are quite happy to have this type of report, because actually, what it brings to the discussion is a very strong and evidence-based analysis on how inequality plays out in the global labor markets. And actually, I think, despite all the pessimism, it's also really, when we talk about the agents of change, it's really something that unifies the developed and the developing world, actually, because as we can see, the trends are the same all over the globe. So this declining labor share is really something that is a policy change challenge, not only for poor countries. It's definitely a huge policy challenge for the developed countries and the most industrialized countries, and even, as you said, the leading export countries of the world, actually. Yeah. So in this sense, there will hopefully be a kind of a drive and a push, really, to discuss more about possible solutions. And I think your presentation has given us a lot of entry points, because what Dr. Lee actually did was saying labor market policies are one instrument, but obviously social policies, macroeconomic policies, trade, financialization, globalization, liberalization, all these are determinants of these processes. So we cannot really find a solution without thinking about a new kind of development approach and a development paradigm where these economic and social policies really work together. So I think this is a very encouraging and very useful for our joint work. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank you also for being here. I would like to remind you to fill in the form and to look again at the book table. And I would also like to announce the next seminar series, which will take place on the 13th of March. At the same time, and we will have Dr. Rosalind Aben from IDS talking about the politics of evidence, which is really
a challenging
theme for all those that are currently working with results-based management frameworks, drive for results in research, etc., etc. So thank you very much, and hope to see you soon.
Thank
you. Check out our other podcasts, available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. If you have any suggestions for future podcasts, email us at press@unris.org. Thank you for listening.